This is lesson 3, in which we will take another look at Israel's history and then go into chapter 1 of Daniel. Let's begin by reviewing the chapter summary for all 12 chapters. In chapter 1, Daniel and his three companions were taken captive and put into the service of King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. In chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed of a statue, and the God of heaven who reveals mysteries gave Daniel the interpretation of the king's dream. In chapter 3, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to bow down to the gold image in the plain of Dura, and God delivered them from the fiery furnace. In chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar again had a dream, this time of a great tree that was chopped down, but the stump was preserved. Again, Daniel interpreted the dream, and the dream was fulfilled in Nebuchadnezzar's temporary insanity until he acknowledged the sovereignty of God Most High. In chapter 5, Belshazzar, who was the last king of Babylon, witnessed a hand writing on the wall. Daniel interpreted the handwriting, and the prophecy of the handwriting was fulfilled that very night as the Medes overthrew the Babylonians. The events of chapter 5 occurred after the events of chapters 7 and 8. In chapter 6, God delivered Daniel from the lion's den when he violated the decree of Darius. Chapter 7 was Daniel's vision of four beasts, 10 horns, and the Son of Man, and here an angel provides the interpretation of Daniel's vision. Chapter 8 is again Daniel's vision, this time of the ram and the male goat, and this vision is interpreted by the angel Gabriel. Chapter 9 contains Daniel's beautiful prayer and Gabriel's response with the message of the 70 weeks and the covenant. Chapter 10 is the introduction to Daniel's vision of chapters 11 and 12. The entire vision begins in chapter 10 with a vision of the man in linen. Chapter 11 is a continuation of what has begun in chapter 10. It contains a revelation of future kings and battles, both in the relatively near future, that is, near to Daniel's future, and also in the very end of times. And chapter 12 is a continuation of chapter 11 with the additional revelation of the great tribulation of 3.5 years and additional time periods of 30 and then another 45 days. Last week, we saw that the book does not progress in chronological order, but because of the time clues given in each chapter, we could establish with some degree of certainty the chronology. Chapters 1, 2, 3, and 4 are followed by chapters 7 and 8. Chapter 5 comes next, and then chapter 9 follows immediately after that. Chapters 10 through 12 follow after chapter 9. I placed chapter 6 at the end, but the precept chart I gave you last week places it just prior to chapters 10 through 12. The key thing to remember is that chapter 6 takes place near the end of Daniel's life, when the Babylonians have been overthrown by the Persians and the Medes. Looking for segments or divisions of the book is another tool of observation. Last week, we saw that there were several possible ways to divide the book, depending upon the point of emphasis. One possibility was to divide the book into two halves. In the first six chapters, the kings dreamed and Daniel interpreted. In the last six chapters, it was Daniel who dreamed or had visions, and angels provided the interpretations. Dividing the book this way is consistent with the fact that the first six chapters are in chronological order, and while the last six chapters are also in chronological order, they dovetail into the events of the first six chapters. If you are dividing the book this way, you could characterize the first six chapters as historical and the last six as apocalyptic. Another possible division of the book of Daniel is based on the change of language in the original from Hebrew to Aramaic and then back to Hebrew. The first chapter and the first few verses of chapter 2, which were written in Hebrew, would constitute an introduction. Then the section written in Aramaic, that is chapters 2 through 7, would describe the times of the Gentiles. And the last section, written in Hebrew again, talks about Israel in relation to the Gentiles. Or you might choose to divide the book into the chapters in which the Babylonian kingdom reigned as one segment. That would be chapters 1 through 5 and 7 and 8. Then the other segment would be the chapters in which the Medo-Persian kingdom reigned. That would be chapters 6 and 9 through 12. Since these are not clean divisions as the others were, such as a loaf of bread cut into two or even a layer cake, for this one I used a marbled cake to depict this division. The theme of the book is that God Most High rules over the realm of mankind. He is sovereign over all men and all nations or kingdoms. Just as I did with lessons 1 and 2, I would like to quote what K. Arthur says in the homework for this week. On page 13, under day 1, number 3, towards the end, K. writes this, "And if you live in accord with what you learn about God, you will know a strength and dynamic of life you never dreamed possible for, quote, the people who know their God will display strength and take action, close quote." She asks where this quote comes from. Did any of you find it? It is in Daniel chapter 11, verse 32. The book of Daniel begins by stating that during the third year of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar besieged Jerusalem. God gave Judah into the hand of the Babylonians. That makes me think about how poetic God's justice is. Someone once defined God's judgment as God giving man what man thinks he wants. Because God was punishing his people for their disobedience to his law and their incessant idolatry, God was saying to Judah, in essence, if you want to worship idols, I will give you over to Babylon, which is a center of idolatry. There you will have plenty of idols to worship. Idolatry is the worship of anything other than the Creator himself. Babylon was synonymous with idol worship. It was also synonymous with anything and everything that stood in opposition to God. Oddly enough, the name Babylon means gate of God. The city is located east of the Euphrates River, about 56 miles south of present-day Baghdad in Iraq. It is located in the fertile plain of Mesopotamia between the two great rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates. You may remember from your world history classes in high school that this area was called the cradle of civilization. Some biblical scholars think that it was the location of the Garden of Eden. Babylon is a most significant place. It was one of the most important cities in the ancient world. It was called the Land of Shinar. It was the land of the Sumerian kings and the land of the Code of Hammurabi, which was the earliest legal code known in history, at least so far. Incidentally, the name Babylon could refer either to the city or to the empire of which it was the capital. In addition to its significance in secular world history, Babylon is also most significant from one cover to the other of the Bible. Originally known as the Land of Shinar, under that name it appears 8 times from Genesis to the book of Zechariah, and under the name of Babylon, it appears 294 times from the book of 2 Kings through the end of the book of Revelation. A city that is named over 300 times in the Bible is clearly something we should pay attention to. Babylon was first mentioned in Genesis chapter 10. After the flood, Noah and his 3 sons and their wives set out to repopulate the earth. The 3 sons were named Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham had a son named Cush, And Cush had a son named Nimrod, who was described in Genesis 10, verse 9, as a mighty hunter before the Lord. Some scholars think that the word that is translated in many Bibles as before the Lord, means against the Lord. Genesis 10:10 says that the beginning of Nimrod's kingdom was Babel and three other cities in the land of Shinar. Let's get our bearings on this map. Here's Babylon in the land of Shinar. Here's the city of Babel, also in the land of Shinar. Nimrod also founded other cities besides Babel, including Nineveh, which became the capital of Assyria. By the way, Nimrod's name means "let us revolt." This was a man in rebellion against God. Genesis 10 is an overview, but then Genesis 11 comes back in and fills in the gaps of history. In Genesis 11 is the story of the building of the Tower of Babel, whose top would reach into heaven. The people wanted to build a city and make a name for themselves, but God came down and confused their language and scattered them. Thus, in Genesis, the book of beginnings, what we see is a change of a worldview from one that fears God to one that wants to make a great name for man. From 2 Kings chapter 17 through Zechariah 6:10, there are over 250 direct references to Babylon. Actually, I counted 272 in the concordance I was using. These books, 2 Kings to Zechariah, cover the time in Israel's history of the kings and the prophets. This is a time of God's judgment upon Israel because while Israel knew about God and occasionally honored God with their lips, their hearts were far from him. They were disobedient and idolatrous. In the New Testament, Babylon is mentioned 12 times, and half of these are in Revelation. This, in Revelation, is the destruction in the future of Babylon, a city, pictured in the book of Revelation as a woman who is drunk with the blood of the saints, that is, people who held to their biblical worldview and would not compromise. The point here is that biblically, Babylon is past, present, and future. Babylon represents a culture and a religion that is in direct opposition to God and his Christ. In the future, there will be a war between God's seed and the seed of the serpent. And at that time, Babylon will be fully and finally destroyed. Returning from that digression on the subject of the name of Babylon, to Daniel chapter 1, we learn that Nebuchadnezzar took some of the vessels from the temple that Solomon had built and put them into the house of his pagan god in what verse 2 calls again the land of Shinar, which we now know was another name for Babylon. At the same time, many of the young nobles and members of the royal family were taken into captivity. In the homework for this week, K. Arthur asks us to look at the books of Leviticus and Deuteronomy to see why the Lord allowed his temple to be emptied by a pagan king and allowed some of his people, even descendants from the line of David, to be taken captive into Babylon. Since the events of Leviticus chapter 11 were before those of Deuteronomy chapter 6, let's begin with that one, Leviticus chapter 11. This is a record of what Israel was to eat and not to eat. The Lord spoke again to Moses and to Aaron, saying to them, "Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, these are the creatures which you may eat from all the animals that are on the earth." Why did God declare some foods clean and others unclean? There are several reasons. The first was to teach them holiness. God is holy and his people were to be holy also. Part of holiness is separation from the world, and Israel's holiness or separation depended partially upon what they ate. One interesting side note is that, in hindsight, we know that a lot of God's requirements had to do with the hygienic and safe handling of food. If God's people followed these requirements carefully, they would naturally be healthier. Another reason that God set out which foods were permissible to eat and which were forbidden was to teach them obedience to Himself in all things and in all aspects of life, even the most common, mundane, everyday activities like eating. In addition, the difference in diet and in the preparation of food would distinguish God's people from all the other nations. This is part of the separation from the world that God required of His people. They were to be different from the rest of the world. And finally, God's people should have willingly and happily obeyed these requirements that applied to everyday living because He was their God and He had blessed them and He had delivered them out of bondage to slavery in Egypt. Verses 44 and 45 of Leviticus chapter 11 summarize God's purposes in distinguishing between the unclean and the clean and between what was edible and what was not to be eaten. Verse 44, "For I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am holy. And you shall not make yourselves unclean with any of the swarming things that swarm on the earth. For I am the Lord who brought you up from the land of Egypt to be your God. Thus you shall be holy, for I am holy." Now let's look at Deuteronomy 6 and see how this relates to Leviticus chapter 11 and to Daniel chapter 1. Remember that Deuteronomy was a second reading of the law. The generation of Israel that had come out of Egypt died in the wilderness for disobeying the Lord. Moses brought the second generation to the border of the land of promise, and there he gave the law again, this time to the new generation. Israel was to fear the Lord and to keep His commandments so that they might live long in the land. They were to love the Lord with all their heart, all their soul, and all their strength. His words were to be in their hearts, and they were to teach them diligently to their children. Verse 20 of Deuteronomy 6 says, "When your son asks you in time to come, saying, 'What do the testimonies and the statutes and the judgments mean, which the Lord our God commanded you?' When that happened, Moses commanded that the fathers should instruct their sons about their history of slavery in Egypt and their deliverance by the hand of the Lord out of Egypt and into the promised land. Therefore, they should be careful to observe all His commands and to love and to serve Him." Evidently, the parents of Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah had followed this instruction of Moses and had taught their sons God's law and why they should keep it. Daniel and his friends knew the dietary laws of the Lord, and they were willing to obey them. From Deuteronomy chapter 6, we moved in the homework to Deuteronomy chapter 28. This chapter sets out the contrast of the blessings and the curses. If Israel obeyed God, He would set them high above all the nations of the earth. Blessings in every area of life would be theirs, and they would be a holy people to God. If, however, they chose to disobey, then curses would come upon them. Verses 36 and 37 and 49 through 57 of Deuteronomy 28 speak of the nation ruling over Israel if they disobeyed the Lord. That nation, we know from hindsight, was Babylon. By now, we all recognize this blue Ishtar gate of Babylon. The Lord warned His people through Moses that He, quote, "will bring you and your king whom you have set over you." Now remember, Moses is saying this to the second generation before they ever enter the promised land. So the time of the kings was about 400 years in the future. That's how far in advance God is giving this warning. Let me go back to the text. God said that He, quote, "will bring you and your king whom you shall set over you to a nation which neither you nor your fathers have known, and there you shall serve other gods, wood and stone." This is Deuteronomy 28, verse 36. Having read Daniel chapter 1, we should recognize what verse 49 of Deuteronomy chapter 28 is saying. This verse reads, "The Lord will bring a nation against you from afar, from the end of the earth, as the eagle swoops down, a nation whose language you shall not understand." Remember that in chapter 1, Daniel and these young men who were being taken into captivity were going to have to learn the Babylonian language, literature, and culture. Verses 52 to 57 of Deuteronomy 28 prophesied that this foreign nation would besiege Jerusalem and that the siege would be so terrible that the people would be reduced to cannibalism. In verses 63 to 65 of Deuteronomy 28, the Lord described his ultimate punishment. He would tear them from the land which they were entering to possess, and he would scatter them among all peoples from one end of the earth to the other, where they would never be allowed to rest. Jeremiah 25, verses 8 through 11, is a similar passage which we looked at in the first 2 weeks of this class. That passage also sets out the term of the exile, which we know is 70 years. But as we also saw in the passages which we looked at in those first 2 weeks, God's threat of punishment was accompanied by the promise of restoration. Deuteronomy 30, verses 1 through 5. "So it shall be, when all of these things have come upon you, the blessing and the curse which I have set before you, and you call them to mind in all the nations where the Lord your God has banished you, and you return to the Lord your God and obey him with all your heart and soul, according to all that I command you today, you and your sons, then the Lord your God will restore you from captivity and have compassion on you and will gather you again from all the peoples where the Lord your God has scattered you. If your outcasts are at the ends of the earth, from there the Lord your God will gather you, and from there he will bring you back. And the Lord your God will bring you into the land which your fathers possessed, and you shall possess it. And he will prosper you and multiply you more than your fathers." But there were cross-references in the homework for Lesson 3, which showed us that Judah was not the first of God's people to suffer the consequences of ongoing disobedience and idolatry. We have looked at this chart several times before. It is on page 131 in the appendix of your materials. The Bible records that Israel sinned against the Lord from the time he led them out of Egypt. Remember that because of Solomon's fall into idolatry through the agency of his many, many foreign wives, God divided the kingdom in 931 BC, shortly after Solomon's death. The southern kingdom was called Judah, and it was ruled by 12 bad and 8 good kings over a period of 345 years. The northern kingdom was called Israel, and it was ruled by a succession of 19 bad kings for a period of 209 years. As you can tell from this chart, God judged the northern kingdom, Israel, first because they had been consistently worshiping the golden calves that Jeroboam, son of Nebat, had set up shortly after the division of the kingdom. It is an astonishing feature of human nature that we are consistently faithful to our idols, but consistently unfaithful to the one and only true and living God. The cross-reference in the homework was first to 2 Kings 15, verse 29. In this passage, we learned that Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, captured part of Israel during the reign of Pekah, king of Israel. The exact year isn't given in this passage, but it would have been before the end of the reign of Pekah in 732 BC. Then, in 2 Kings chapter 17, two chapters later, we are told that Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, besieged the capital of Israel, which was Samaria, for 3 years. Assyria then took the northern kingdom, Israel, captive in 722 BC. Now, the southern kingdom of Judah knew what had happened to the northern kingdom of Israel, and they also knew why. Yet, just like people today, they hardened their hearts against God and they stiffened their necks and they did not believe that God would judge them. But we know that he did. He sent the Babylonians, who besieged Jerusalem 3 times, and finally in 586 BC, they destroyed the temple that Solomon had built, destroyed the city of Jerusalem, and laid waste the land of Judah. Last week, we looked at this map, which shows the geographical territory of the Babylonian Empire overlaid on the existing political boundaries of the countries of the Middle East. We saw that the Babylonian Empire comprised all of what is now Israel, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, and also included parts of Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt. Before I switch to the next slide, which shows the geographical boundaries of the Assyrian Empire, which preceded the Babylonian Empire, let's get our bearings with this map. The Babylonian Empire bordered on the Mediterranean Sea, went up into Turkey, but not so far as the Black Sea or the Caspian Sea. It did extend down to the Persian Gulf and all the way down the Arabian Peninsula to the Red Sea. Now, this is the Assyrian Empire, which we remember preceded the Babylonian Empire. It also bordered on the Mediterranean Sea, but unlike the Babylonian Empire, which followed, it went all the way up into Turkey to the Black Sea. Like the Babylonian Empire, it also extended down to the Persian Gulf, but it did not go down into the Arabian Peninsula and into Egypt until much later than the time that this map depicts, which is the initial deportation of the Israelites under Tiglath-Pileser. Have you noticed the similarities in the boundaries of these two empires? In the map of the Assyrian Empire, here is Nineveh, the capital. But here is the city of Babylon, which became the capital of the Babylonian Empire when they conquered the Assyrian Empire. Here is a map that shows the routes that Israel took as they went into captivity, either into Assyria, in the case of the Northern Kingdom, or into Babylon, in the case of the Southern Kingdom. On this map, the purple arrows show the various places in Assyria to which the Israelite captives were taken. The red arrows going backwards show Gentiles from the area of Babylon that the Assyrians took to replace the Israelites. This was a very effective method of conquest. If you export a conquered people out of their land and you import your own people into that conquered land, at least two results would be: one, a reduced likelihood of rebellion from the conquered and now displaced people, and two, probable assimilation of the conquered people into your own culture, which also happened to serve to reduce the threat of rebellion from them. And that is what apparently happened. The 10 northern tribes known as Israel were assimilated into the Gentile people into whose land they were exiled, and they lost their distinct identity as Jews or Israelites. Meanwhile, the few remaining Israelites left in the land by the Assyrians intermarried with the imported Gentiles. That is why the Jews of Jesus' time hated the people of Samaria. They considered them to be half-breeds, not real Jews. Now, the green arrows on the map show the routes that the Babylonians used to take the Israelites from Judah into captivity. Now, here is another map that shows basically the same things. The red and brown lines represent the Assyrian captivity, and the green and blue lines represent the Babylonian captivity and return. Notice that the route of the Babylonian captivity traced the course of the Euphrates River. Because the Assyrian captivity occurred 700 years before Christ, and the Babylonian captivity occurred between 500 and 600 years before Christ, clearly, these Israelites, these what we would now call Jews, were not hauled away to concentration camps in rail cars as they were during the Holocaust of World War II. How then did they get to this place of captivity? They walked. But how far is it from Jerusalem to Babylon? A straight line from Jerusalem to Babylon would be about 500 miles, but the route that was taken was between 800 and 900 miles. Can you imagine walking that distance? You have to wonder how many died along the way. And this brings us to the three Babylonian sieges of Judah. From this chart, we can see that they occurred in 605 BC, 597 BC, and the final one was in 586 BC. This chart appears in your material at the back of Lesson 3. It is on page 20. You can see that I added Daniel chapter 1 to the list of citations for the first siege. It is in filling out charts like this that the precept inductive study method shines. Through the use of extensive cross-referencing and making lists and filling out charts, we can see how the Bible itself gives us a complete and comprehensive picture of the historical events that shaped the setting for the book of Daniel. Let's begin with the first siege. This occurred when Jehoiakim was king of Judah. We've already read that in Daniel chapter 1. This was in 605 BC, and at that time, Daniel and his friends were taken into captivity. As we fill in the chart on page 20 of your materials, we will be answering the five W's, who, what, where, when, and why, and the H, how. We want to read these cross-references with a purpose, and that is to know and understand what it is we are reading. Who was reigning in Judah at the time of the first Babylonian siege in 605 BC? Well, we already know that. It was Jehoiakim. We get that information from Daniel 1, verse 1. At the time of this siege, Nebuchadnezzar allowed Jehoiakim to remain on the throne, although he served at the pleasure of and under the authority of Nebuchadnezzar. Jehoiakim submitted for the first 3 years of his 11-year reign, but then he rebelled. Nebuchadnezzar came up against him, and now we can answer the questions who and what was captured and where it was taken. It says he took sons of the royal family and sons of the nobility, as well as some of the vessels of God's temple to Babylon. 2 Chronicles 36 verse 6 says that Nebuchadnezzar bound Jehoiakim with bronze chains to take him to Babylon. Apparently, however, Nebuchadnezzar never followed through because the prior verse, verse 6, says that Jehoiakim reigned all 11 years in Jerusalem. Also, and I don't know if this was included in the cross-references of the homework, Jeremiah 22 verses 18 and 19 indicate that Jehoiakim died in Jerusalem. Verses 18 and 19 say, "Therefore, thus says the Lord in regard to Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, they will not lament for him. He will be buried with a donkey's burial, dragged off and thrown out beyond the gates of Jerusalem." Now, since this is the first siege, we know from extra-biblical history that Nabopolassar, who was Nebuchadnezzar's father, died during the time of this first siege, and Nebuchadnezzar had to hurry home to make sure that he was claiming the throne and that no one else usurped it in his absence. My interpretation is that he intended to take Jehoiakim with him, but did not because he left in a hurry. This means that the answer to the question who was left in Jerusalem would include Jehoiakim and most of the people of Judah. When Jehoiakim died, he was succeeded by his son Jehoiakim. Now the spelling of the two names begins the same, J-E-H-O-I-A, but the father's name ends in K-I-M, and the son's name ends in chin, C-H-I-N, but it's pronounced kin, K-I-N. Unfortunately for the son, Jehoiakim, that was the time of the second siege in 597 BC. As a result, he lasted only 3 months on the throne in Jerusalem before being taken captive to Babylon in the eighth year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, according to 2 Kings 24, verse 12. Let's complete the chart for the second siege. The king of Judah was Jehoiakim, the son of Jehoiakim. When Nebuchadnezzar came to the city of Jerusalem, Jehoiakim came out of the city to meet him, along with his mother and his servants and his captains and his officials. Nebuchadnezzar took all of them, as well as all the craftsmen and the smiths, all totaling 10,000 captives. The prophet Ezekiel, who was a contemporary of Daniel's, was also taken into captivity with this group. We know this to be the case not only from this chart of Israel's division and captivity that we are provided in the precept materials, but also because Ezekiel prophesied about the third siege while he was among the exiles. This is in the first chapter and first few verses of the book of Ezekiel. What was taken, Nebuchadnezzar also took all the treasures of the Lord's house and the treasures of the king's palace, and he cut into pieces all the vessels of gold which Solomon had made in the temple of the Lord. From Jeremiah 27 verses 19 and 20, we learn, however, that Nebuchadnezzar left behind the pillars, the sea, the stands, and the rest of the vessels for use in the temple. In this artist's depiction of Solomon's temple, you can see the pillars on either side of the door, and in the foreground is depicted what was called the Brazen Sea, or it's also called the Bronze Sea. All of these things were made with bronze. That's out of 1 Chronicles 18, verse 8. But the Lord told Jeremiah in Jeremiah 27, verses 21 and 22, that these things would be taken to Babylon as well. Nebuchadnezzar made Jehoiakim's uncle, Mattaniah, the king in Jehoiakim's place. Remember, he was taking Jehoiakim with him to Babylon. And Nebuchadnezzar changed Mattaniah's name to Zedekiah. He was left behind, Zedekiah was, along with the poorest people of the land. By the way, Jeremiah in chapter 24, verse 1, refers to Jehoiakim as Jeconiah. You'll see that name used sometimes as an alternate for Jehoiakim. But the context makes it clear that he is referring to the son of Jehoiakim. Zedekiah, formerly Mattaniah, was the last king of Judah. His reign was cut short when Jerusalem and the temple were utterly destroyed, and he was taken with most of the rest of the people of Judah into captivity in Babylon. About 4 years before this third and final siege of Jerusalem, Ezekiel, who you remember was taken into captivity in the second siege, prophesied while he was among the exiles, saying that one-third would die by plague or famine, one-third would fall by the sword, and one-third would be scattered. They would be bereaved of their children. Because of their ongoing and rebellious disobedience, God would execute these just judgments upon them. This is in Ezekiel 5, verses 12 through 17. Now let's get the specifics of the third siege in 586 BC. We have already established that the king of Judah was Zedekiah, the former Mattaniah, the uncle of Jehoiakim. This third and final siege began 9 years after the second siege, and this last one lasted 2 years. This must have been the time that Deuteronomy chapter 28 foretold, which we looked at earlier today, in which the famine was so severe that the people resorted to cannibalism. This was also predicted in Jeremiah 19, verses 7 through 9, which was not in your homework, by the way, Jeremiah 19, verses 7 through 9, and it was also predicted in Ezekiel 5, verse 10. When the Babylonians broke into the city, the men of war and King Zedekiah fled by night. But the Babylonians pursued him and captured him and brought him to Nebuchadnezzar. All of Zedekiah's sons were slaughtered before his eyes, and then they put out the eyes of Zedekiah, bound him with bronze fetters, and brought him to Babylon. Just as Jeremiah had prophesied in chapter 27, verses 19 through 22, the bronze pillars and the bronze or brazen sea of the temple were broken into pieces, and the bronze was carried away to Babylon. The Babylonians also took away the pots, the shovels, the snuffers, the spoons, and all the bronze vessels which were used in temple service. They also took away the fire pans and the basins, whatever was fine gold and whatever was fine silver. Then the temple, the king's palace, and all the houses of Jerusalem were set on fire. The city walls were broken down, and the city was utterly destroyed. Despite the fact that 2 Kings 24 verse 14 says that none remained in the land except the poorest people, and this is after the second siege, when you get to the next chapter, 2 Kings 25 verses 18 through 22 indicate that the Babylonians had not taken, or perhaps had not managed to find in order to take, a chief priest and another priest and three officers of the temple. In addition, the Babylonians found an official who was an overseer of the men of war and five of the king's advisors and a scribe of the captain of the army, as well as 60 men of the people of the land. All these people they collected and put them to death at the same place where the sons of Zedekiah were executed. 2 Kings chapter 24 verses 11 and 12 state that the rest of the people who were still in the city of Jerusalem and the deserters who had deserted to the king of Babylon and the rest of the multitude were carried away into exile. But the Babylonians left some of the poorest of the land to be vine dressers and plowmen. The exiles would remain in Babylon for 70 years to fulfill the word of the Lord by the prophet Jeremiah. And now we will return to the first siege, because that brings us to Daniel chapter 1. Daniel chapter 1, beginning at verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel's, including some of the royal family and of the nobles, youths in whom was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving in the king's court. And he ordered him to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank. And he appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. Now among them from the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. I guess Azariah didn't make it into this picture. You can just see the edge of his face on the far right of the picture. Verse 7, then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them, and to Daniel he assigned the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah, Shadrach, to Mishael, Meshach, and to Azariah, Abednego. Their Hebrew names, which were related to God, Jehovah God, were changed to names that reflected the Babylonian gods. Consider for a moment what was involved in learning a new language. We know what Hebrew looks like. Here's a picture of it. But what form of writing did the Chaldeans or Babylonians use? The world's earliest form of writing that represented more than just pictures, those would be called pictograms, The earliest form was cuneiform, and it seems logical that it did evolve here in Mesopotamia, which is the cradle of civilization between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. Although I should point out that cuneiform also appeared in Egypt around the same time that it appeared in Mesopotamia, which was about 3,500 years B.C., 3,500 years B.C. Daniel is taking place at about 586 B.C. Cuneiform came to function both phonetically, it represented a sound, but also semantically, it represented a meaning, such as an object or perhaps an abstract concept. Rather than only representing objects directly as a picture, cuneiform was an improvement upon pictures. The term, the word cuneiform, denotes not one, but several kinds of writing systems. In fact, the word cuneiform comes from the Latin cuneus, which means wedge. Therefore, any script can be called cuneiform as long as the individual signs are composed of wedges. Here is a picture of a cuneiform tablet. The writing is all straight edges and wedges. I see triangles and arrows. The language of the Chaldeans or Babylonians was some variation of cuneiform. So for Daniel and his peers to learn this on top of their Hebrew would perhaps be the equivalent of our having to learn Chinese, either Mandarin or Cantonese, on top of English. Not an easy task. Why did Nebuchadnezzar take the royal children and the children of nobility into his court? There are several possible reasons, and they are not mutually exclusive. One is that they could serve as hostages that would keep the remainder of the royal family in line. Their presence there would also serve as a constant reminder, a pleasant reminder, to Nebuchadnezzar of his successful military conquest. Another reason could be that once these young men had been trained in the Babylonian language and culture, they could serve in the administration of Jewish affairs under the Babylonian authority. And another reason, we talked about this one before, was that deportation and assimilation of a conquered people significantly diminished the possibility of a later revolt. It was a very common tactic of the Babylonians and a very successful one. Now let's go back to the text of Daniel chapter 1, beginning at verse 8. But Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Now God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. And the commander of the officials said to Daniel, I am afraid of my lord the king, who has appointed your food and your drink. For why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youths who are your own age? Then you would make me forfeit my head to the king. But Daniel said to the overseer whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days, and let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be observed in your presence, and the appearance of the youths who are eating the king's choice food, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. There were actually two problems with the diet which Nebuchadnezzar had ordered for the young captives. The word that is translated into English in the NASB as appointed in verse 5 is really a much stronger word. It amounts to a command. The first problem, of course, is that the food would not have met the requirements of the Mosaic Law. Because Daniel and his companions had been born during that revival under King Josiah, and because they had been taught the Mosaic Law, they understood that the reason they were in Babylon at all was that God was punishing Judah for its disobedience to the law. They understood that obedience to God's law was of paramount importance, whether they were at home in Judah or in captivity in Babylon. The second problem was that both the wine and the meat had most probably been dedicated to the Babylonian idols before it was placed on the king's table or before the young men. Again, therefore, to partake of it would be tantamount to giving praise and thanks to the false idols. There are many lessons to learn from the way that Daniel handled this matter. First is the fact that he made up his mind. By the way, his three companions are implicitly included in that decision. We know that because they were faithful to God to the point of facing the fiery furnace rather than bow down to the image of gold in the plain of Dura. The point here is that it was a predetermined decision. Daniel and his companions were familiar enough with the requirements of God's law and with the consequences of disobedience that they had already fixed their minds on obedience. Second is the fact that Daniel chose his battles wisely. He made no objection to the changing of his name, even though the new name included a reference to the Babylonian god Bel, and he did not rebel against being taught the Babylonian language, literature, and culture, even though that would have included learning about the Babylonian gods and the Babylonian magic arts. He knew that having his name changed and having to learn about this pagan culture were not a violation of God's law for which Israel had been sent into captivity. But the matter of food, unlike the other issues, was expressly addressed in the Mosaic law. And this tells us something about the strength of this very young man's knowledge of the character of his God and his faith in him. The Babylonians were notorious for their cruelty. They were utterly barbaric, and they placed very little value on life, especially the life of a captive. Daniel had to have understood that the least bit of resistance could mean torture and death. In the face of that, to choose to obey God over a human king is to really understand who God is. Third is the diplomatic manner in which Daniel made his objection known. He didn't scream and holler and make a scene. He didn't go on a hunger strike. He courteously requested. He sought permission from those in authority over him. And verse 9 says that God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. I think that is because of the prior two factors. God knew that, one, Daniel had predetermined that he would continue to obey God's law even in a foreign land, and two, Daniel was submitting to the authority of the power that God was using to judge Israel, at least in matters that did not contravene God's law. Daniel understood that God was sovereign over Babylon too. Daniel respected the position that Ashpenaz was in, and he negotiated accordingly. It is clear that God did intervene on Daniel's part by preparing the way for his request. Ashpenaz could have peremptorily denied Daniel's request, but instead he explained his fear that anything negative that happened to the captives could result in his losing his own head, and that response allowed Daniel to negotiate a trial period. The request to eat vegetables included a broad category of food. It included food that grows out of the ground. Literally, it is the sown, S-O-W-N, things. Incidentally, don't you find it interesting that only four of the young teenagers taken captive from Judah raised this objection? Conspicuous by its absence is any objection from the rest of the young sons of Judah's royalty and nobility. This makes the resolve of these four teenagers who were going against the grain of what all their peers were doing all the more remarkable. Now let's return to the text of Daniel 1, beginning at verse 15 through the end. And at the end of 10 days, their appearance seemed better, and they were fatter than all the youths who had been eating the king's choice food. So the overseer continued to withhold their choice food and the wine they were to drink and kept giving them vegetables. And as for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. Then at the end of the days which the king had specified for presenting them, the commander of the officials presented them before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king talked with them, and out of them all, not one was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's personal service. And as for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in all his realm. And Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus the king. God poured out his blessings on these young teenagers who continued to be obedient to God during a very traumatic time in their young lives. They had been torn from their families and removed from all that was familiar to them. They had endured an 800 to 900 mile trek to a foreign land with a foreign language and a foreign culture and a foreign religion. And then they had applied themselves carefully, assiduously, to their 3-year course of study. And through all of that, they had remained faithful to God. And so God blessed them with not only knowledge, but discernment. They had wisdom and understanding. Just as Moses had been steeped in the wisdom of Egypt, Daniel needed to be well trained in the Babylonian wisdom so that he would be able to put to shame the wisdom of this world by the wisdom of the God in heaven who reveals mysteries. Of the four young men, only Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Of the four, only he was a true prophet. Verse 20 of chapter 1 says that Nebuchadnezzar found that these young teenagers were 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in all his realm. The expression literally translated is 10 hands better. Clearly, these young men were outstandingly superior to all their peers, and Nebuchadnezzar, who was an intelligent man himself, recognized their gifting. Nevertheless, there is no indication given to us in chapter 1 that they were immediately given any position among the wise men or conjurers of Babylon. That might be one reason that they were not called to interpret the dream of chapter 2. The last verse of chapter 1 says that Daniel stayed in the king's service for the entire 70 years of the captivity until the first year of Cyrus the king. Thus, chapter 1 introduces Daniel, showing us that before we met him, God had called him and prepared him, and Daniel had matured and been blessed by God. Because Daniel and his companions made up their minds that they would honor God and his law by not defiling themselves with the pagan king's food, God stepped in and blessed them in every single area of their lives. Today, we are under the new covenant, and the dietary restrictions of the Mosaic Law do not apply to us anymore. But the same principles that govern Daniel's behavior do apply to us. We also need to make up our minds that we will not defile ourselves with sin, but instead we will honor God with our minds and our mouths and our actions. Once we really grasp the fact that God is sovereign over all the nations and all kings and all presidents and over all people in authority, then we will trust him and we will defend his sovereignty, and that trust and that faith will manifest itself in our actions. Like Daniel, we live in a culture that is not only pagan, but that is becoming more and more overtly opposed to Christianity. Just a few weeks ago, a boy in a public high school in Fort Worth was suspended from school because a teacher overheard him say in a private conversation with another boy that because he was a Christian, he believed that homosexual behavior was sinful. Fortunately, there has been a backlash, but the suspension, although it was changed to in-school suspension, was upheld, and the black mark stays on this boy's records. In a small way, that boy honored God, and I trust that God will honor him as well. May we make up our minds now that we too will honor God as we live our lives in this foreign culture. May we purify our hearts and not defile ourselves with the sinful ways of this world, even if someday we too face the threat of a horrible death in a fiery furnace or in the teeth of wild animals. May our lives be such a contrast to the norm that even pagans will have to acknowledge the power and the sovereignty of our God. Remember what K. Arthur said in the homework. And if you live in accord with what you learn about God, you will know a strength and dynamic of life you never dreamed possible for. And here she quotes Daniel 11:32, "The people who know their God will display strength and take action." Our closing hymn. Before the Lord's eternal throne, ye nations, bow with sacred joy. Know that the Lord is God alone. He can create and he destroy. His sovereign power without our aid formed us of clay and gave us breath. And when like wandering sheep we strayed, he saved us from the power of death. We are his people, we his care, our souls and all our mortal frame. What lasting honors shall we rear, Almighty Maker, to thy name? We'll crowd thy gates with thankful songs, high as the heaven our voices raise, and earth with her 10,000 tongues shall fill thy courts with sounding praise. Wide as the world is thy command, vast as eternity thy love. Firm as a rock thy truth must stand, when rolling years shall cease to move. Amen.